Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Joel, we've got listener questions this episode, man. We've got five great ones like we always do.
Except for that one. There's that one bad one.
That's true. Well, we had one bad one, but then we replaced it. We kicked it to the curb.
Yeah, we're like, no, we're not going to take that question.
But we've got several good ones here, including one about CDs, certificates of deposit. We're going to talk about shopping for the best mortgage interest rate, as well as HSAs, health savings accounts, whether or not you have to use the one that is offered by your employer. We're going to get to that plus two others in this episode, man. But first, I know you wanted to mention something. Let's talk a little bit about buying kitchen appliances.
Oh, yeah. Super sexy topic right here. I did buy a new fridge for our family recently. And yeah, the one we were rolling with was pretty old, had like a broken bottom shelf. It's one of those top and bottom, you know, freezer on the top, fridge on the bottom.
A simple fridge.
Very simple, very old school, and just kind of crummy at this point.
It's the fridge that came with your house too, right? It's, you didn't buy this fridge. It was the house that they left there when you purchased the home several years ago.
Right, and the homeowner then probably had the fridge for 10 years. Yeah. Like it's probably a 15-year-old fridge, which is fine. It was still working. But I saw this sale on floor model appliances at Best Buy. And so, you know, it's something that had been on Emily and I's radar for a while. Like, hey, if we found a great deal on a new fridge, we'd do it. I saw Costco had this fridge, was $1,100 on sale. And I was like, that's a pretty good deal. But then Best Buy had the same fridge, but floor modeled for $600.
Dang.
Yeah. So I was like, that's a really good deal.
A really good deal, dude.
So I had to pounce and I took all the seats out of the 2006 minivan or however old our minivan is. And I drove down to Best Buy, mask on, doing my pickup. And man, it's been awesome. And I got to say, I was able to sell the old fridge on the Facebook marketplace really easily. People are always looking for working old fridges that are super cheap. So really, I'm only out of pocket $500 to massively upgrade to a brand new fridge. And I'm always down for doing something like that. I think there's some useful life left in that refrigerator that somebody else is going to enjoy. But we were just completely tired of it. We needed something new. And we were just waiting for the moment where we found a deal. And here's why I like to do this too, Matt.
Tell me.
if there is, let's say next week, the fridge that we currently have bites the dust. Well, then I'm kind of forced to find something in a really short period of time. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I know that I want to upgrade that fridge, but I bide my time, I look around and I wait for the deal, and then I sell the working fridge that I have that I don't want anymore, well, I can wait to find the best possible price. And that's what I was able to do here. And so, yeah, sometimes that's kind of how I think about the life cycle of an appliance is can I wait and find the best possible deal? And then I'll trade out the old one.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially when it comes to something like a fridge where there are groceries, you know, on the line. Essentially, if your fridge craps out, you're going to lose a lot of money as it is with all the stuff that you have in your fridge.
All the filet mignon that I got sitting in there.
All those cuts of meat in your freezer. I know you've got a lot of meat in there. But yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, to be honest, when it comes to a fridge or a freezer. Like, obviously, you're going to lose some money when it comes to your actual groceries. But you're just on a time crunch. Like, once it does crap out, you are going to scramble and try to see if you can, you know, hopefully find a really good deal. But I like your method, man. I feel that I tend to side on the simplicity and ease of use. You know, just I'm going to keep my life cruising along until something happens when it comes to something like this that I don't really care about. We're happy with our fridge and freezer at the moment, but at the same time, it could totally bite the dust tomorrow. And yeah, we would be in a situation where we were scrambling.
And you're like, oh man, those Memorial Day sales are over. And now I got to pay full price for a fridge or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And plus too, like you getting that floor model, I've only ever gotten one floor model and it was on like a range hood, you uh-huh. know? It was half the cost. And so that was huge. I mean, my personal favorite is just picking up appliances on the side of the road. Like, we've got a microwave and a toaster that were curb alerts from the side of the road. And that doesn't mean that they were nasty. They were just thrown out. I have no idea. Like, literally, the toaster we've been using for the past 5 years now. It's got four slots for toast.
There you go.
The thing puts out the toast, man.
Oh, by the way, I want to say something about transporting a fridge on its side.
Which nice
you're not actually supposed to transport a fridge laying down.
Well, you can.
You can.
But there's a step that you need to take.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you're going
to
say?
Yep. So basically, you know, it's better to transport them upright, like in a truck with like a safety harness, right? You want it to not fall out of the back
like
of
the ratchet
truck.
Straps or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. But because I didn't want to bother any friends with the truck or anything like that, I was just like, I got this van. I think I can stick it in there. I did some research and basically it looked like it was okay to transport a fridge on its back as long as you give it ample time upright to kind of get reacclimated because of something that happens with the condenser, the oil that drains upward or something like that. So the fridge basically needs time to get back to its normal state and to allow that oil to kind of drop back down.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was only on its back for about 25 minutes when I was picking it up. And then I got home, turned it upright. I did not plug it in for the first 6 hours that I had at home. Just to be sure, just to give it that extra time, because I would prefer my fridge just to work. Right. So, because yeah, that's just kind of something interesting I learned Googling how to transport fridges.
Yeah, man, that's a great tip. You don't want to shorten the life of your fridge. You want it to last another 15, 20 years until you sell the house that you're currently in.
Yeah.
To the next person who's like, oh man, this fridge sucks. All right, man, let's go ahead and kick it to the beer. This episode, we're enjoying a Pseudo Sue Pale Ale. This is by Toppling Goliath Brewing Company, sent to us by Kelsey in Iowa. And this beer is kind of related to another beer that we've actually had on the show. So we'll get to our thoughts on this one, our tasting notes, at the end of the episode.
Yeah, we sure will. But Matt, on to listener questions. For anybody out there who wants to submit a question for a future episode, well, we'd love to hear it. Just go to our website, howtomoney.com/ask. Simple instructions there for how you can submit your voice question. And the first one we're taking on the show today is about paying cash for a house. This is from listener Brianna.
Hi, Joel and Matt. I'm moving from California to Wisconsin to take a job at the University of Madison. We will be paying cash for a house, and I'm not sure how to determine whether I should expect a cash discount and how much that discount should be. I really feel like I'm in over my head, and I want to make a good offer on this house. I really like it. I think it's the perfect fit for us. I want to get a good deal, but I also want to be fair. The whole COVID thing has really just turned the real estate market upside down, and I'm just not sure what to do. And just in case you think I'm in a better financial position than I am, you should know that I've been a starving student for a long time, and we actually put a mortgage on our California house so that we can pay cash for the Wisconsin house. Thank you so much for your help. I really appreciate your advice and your show. Bye.
Brianna, that's a great question, and so glad that you have been able to find the perfect house for you. Matt, this is a great question. I don't think we've gotten it on the show before about paying cash for a house. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners are like, who can pay cash for a house? Right? That is something that for the longest time didn't make any sense to me. Like, how does anybody save up enough money to pay cash for a house? And, you know, Brianna gave us a little insight there. She's doing a cash out refi on another home that she owns in order to be able to pay cash for this house. But I think this question brings up a lot of interesting things about what a cash offer means and how it changes a potential real estate transaction.
Yeah, regardless of what side of the transaction that you're on, right? And Brianna, yeah, let's talk about kind of like your approach here. You know, let's talk about how you got that mortgage on your house in California. You know, assuming you owned it outright, like this is an awesome way to go about things. You know, taking some of that equity out of that home with a cash out refinance is a great way to put you in a strong position when looking for a new home. You can, you know, take your time with that cash out refi, secure the best rate possible, and, you know, then you'll be able to pounce with cash, you know, when you find that perfect house, which it sounds like you're doing. And so, Joel, it's almost like you with your fridge, right? Like you kind of had that entire deal lined up a little bit before you needed it, before you had to scramble and then, you know, hopefully find a fridge that was on sale.
Yeah, Brianna and I both doing some next level thinking, Matt.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks, you know, have that option maybe when it comes to a fridge. Fewer folks maybe have that option when it comes to houses. But if you do have that ability, man, I think that's a really brilliant way of going about it.
Yeah, let's talk about what being a cash buyer does for somebody, Matt. Like, and basically what it does, a cash buyer is in a more favorable position. They're looked at better by someone who's selling a home because they've got the cash on hand to be able to pay for it. And sellers love a cash buyer. They love them so much that sometimes they are willing to take less money for the home. And that's because cash buyers are basically a much more sure thing. The deal's not going to fall through because of a financing contingency or a buyer's inability to get a loan for the property. If I'm a seller, that's the thing I'm most worried about. If I've got an offer on the table that's all cash and an offer on the table that is someone who's got to get financing, if they're the exact same, I'm taking the cash buyer every single time. And at the same time, cash buyers can often close more quickly, which means if I'm trying to sell the house, I'm going to sell it faster and the deal's going to get done. There's just a lot more certainty. And at the same time, Matt, if that deal were to fall through when you have a non-cash buyer, well, relisting it is a huge pain. It can put a seller's plans on hold for moving into a new home that they're buying. And financially, also, it could mean that they're going to get less for their home. That home is now less appealing if it's been under contract and it's gone back on the market. It's almost kind of snake bitten, right? And so I think that cash buyer is going to be huge for Brianna. Sellers really, really like it for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, and part of that from like the seller's standpoint, like they want their house, you know, on the market as few days as possible, right? Like the days on market. Buyers and agents who are looking on behalf of buyers, they use that as a signal. Like that tells them whether or not there's something kind of odd with this house. You know, you see a house with like 45 days on the market, like that's not a great sign.
It's getting a little long in the tooth.
Yeah, and you know, when the house has been on the market that long, there very well could be something wrong with it, or maybe it has fallen through. And Brianna, you know, you mentioned wanting to make a fair offer as well. You know, this is where having a good realtor is clutch. Having someone on your team who lives and breathes that specific market, they're going to know how far that they can push the envelope without losing the deal outright. Because obviously, like, you want this house, right? You know, this is especially true when you found a house that you really like, because it's important to have someone as an intermediary to help remove some of the emotions from that equation. You know, when it feels like you have a lot on the line, it can feel like that your emotions are cranked up to 11. And so I think there's a better chance of making a costly mistake when your emotions are high, when you found, you know, what you think might be the perfect house. And it might be the perfect house for you, but you still want to have somebody who can kind of walk you through that situation and work on your behalf.
Yeah, man, I know when we bought the house that we currently live in, that we've been in for about 6 years, we went above asking price. And my realtor was this calm voice because we really wanted to get the house and we were willing to go above asking price. But she also knew, don't go too far above, because I'm pretty sure I know what this house is going to go for. We felt like we still got a good deal. Yeah, so her voice of reason was clutch in helping us, you know, pay the right price for that house.
Nice.
Yeah, and so we need to also answer Brianna's question about, well, can she expect to get a discount for being a cash buyer? And that really does depend on so many different factors. It depends on the market and the reasons that the seller has for selling the home, right? If they're looking to get out of the home immediately and it has been on the market a little bit longer, let's say 3 or 4 months, then there's a good chance anybody is going to get a discount buying that home, but in particular, if you're a cash buyer. But when demand is high and the seller's in more control, the likelihood that you're going to score a discount is unlikely. But of course, that cash offer, like we said, makes it more likely that you're going to get the house if there are multiple similar offers. So yeah, being a cash buyer puts you in a great position to buy a home, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get a lower price of 4%, 5%, 6% off the listing price. But it does mean that there's a much better chance you're actually going to get under contract on the home that you really want to buy.
Yeah, and Joel, you know, cash winning out on a multiple offer situation, that's probably especially true now given the economic downturn that we kind of found ourselves in. Lenders are tightening their lending standards. So there are a lot of folks who maybe previously qualified, but because their financial situations have changed a little bit, those deals might fall through. The seller knows that, and so they are going to be more likely to go with the sure thing, which is cash.
Yeah, the cash buyer becomes even more important in today's scenario. I think you're right. All right, Matt, let's get to a couple more questions, including the next one about HSAs and whether or not you have to use your employer's HSA plan, and we'll get to those right after the break.
All right, Joe, we're back from the break taking listener questions. This one is about an HSA, which is a health savings account. Let's hear it.
Hi, guys. This is Mike from Columbus calling in. I had a question regarding an employer HSA and then moving that into a personal HSA. This year, my employer is changing their health plan, and because of that, I'm switching over to my wife's plan through her employer, which means there'll be no more contributions from myself or the employer to the HSA that they opened for me. The bank that it's through, they have investment options, but they don't even have a web portal for it. Everything you want to do, you have to do over the phone. So I'm looking into options in terms of what to do with that money, and I didn't even realize that you have the option of transferring the HSA to another provider. So I wanted to see if you guys could speak to that a little bit and see if you have any recommendations or thoughts on that process. Thanks.
Hey, Mike, we are happy to share our thoughts on this with you, man. First thing, though, you know, you mentioned that your new health coverage will be a plan with your wife's employer. An important distinction is that you can transfer or roll over your HSA to a new administrator no matter what. But if you want to be able to continue to contribute to the HSA, you need to make sure that your new health coverage is a qualifying high deductible health plan. That may or may not be the case, so make sure you look that up.
Yeah, good point, Matt. So if he's moving over to his wife's insurance and it is a high deductible plan, he can contribute to the HSA that he's establishing when he rolls over his old one into a plan with a new provider. Very good point. Also, too, Mike, transferring your HSA funds, right? Generally speaking, once the funds are deposited in a work HSA, you can move that money to another provider. A lot of people don't really realize this. They think they have to keep their money inside of their employer's HSA plan. I will say there might be some sort of transfer fee you'll incur for sending that money to another HSA administrator, but depending on the fees and investing options you have available, it's likely a really good choice to do this. Most HSA providers have high fees and few good investing options. And so getting to pick the company that you do business with who does have a lot of good investing options and low fees is going to be how you want to go.
Yeah. Plus, you know, he mentioned that his current HSA administrator doesn't even have online access. You know, like this isn't 2009 anymore. Like nobody wants to have to make a phone call to check their account balance. I mean, it makes me think of flip phones, Joel, like where you had to dial in, like actually call a number or press and hold one or whatever to hear your voicemail. You know, I want visual voicemail. I want to be able to see stuff. We're visual creatures. And so, Mike, I don't like that you don't have easy access to all of your information online where you can easily see your investing options and any of those potential fees. You know, that administrator might be great, but just a lack of transparency is sort of a red flag to me. It may not be the best option for you because there could be those hidden fees.
Yeah, Matt, we just talked transfers, but there's also something called an HSA rollover, and there is a difference. So I think we do have to clarify that as well, right? If you request a rollover instead, your HSA administrator or custodian, they'll send you the money, Mike, and you'll have to make the deposit within 60 days to your new HSA. Otherwise, you're hit with income tax and a 20% penalty on that money. You don't want to make that mistake. That's a very costly mistake, right? So that's the rollover, but a transfer is when you go directly from one HSA administrator to another one. The money doesn't enter your hands at all, and there's no penalties that way. Just the potential transfer fee that I mentioned before.
Yeah, and it's important to note as well, when it comes to transfers, there are no limits on the number of transfers that you can do from one custodian to another custodian. But if you're looking at doing a rollover, you can only do one of those a year. And Mike, Lively and Fidelity, they are our favorite HSA providers. If you know you're going to be investing your HSA money, which would be our preference, of course, they both offer ultra low cost options for you. We've talked before about how the HSA is sort of like this ultimate retirement account. We talked about that in episode 105. But if you can actually pay out of pocket for your health expenses and continue to, you know, channel this pre-tax money into this account where it can grow tax-free, and then down the road you can withdraw it also tax-free, that's where you get that triple tax advantage.
Yeah, the HSA, such a good account.
The triple crown. Yeah. Let's start calling it that.
You never, ever pay tax on that money if you use it properly, which is incredible. And so I guess some people might be asking, well, I have a high deductible savings account through my employer. They have a company that they do business with where I can open an HSA. But Matt and Joel just said Lively and Fidelity are the best. So should I even be putting money into my employer's HSA, or should I be going directly and opening my own? That's a good question. But there are actually some perks to putting that money inside of your employer sponsored plan first. Basically, when you're putting money in an HSA through your employer, you're avoiding some of that payroll tax, which is awesome, which is clutch.
7.65%.
That's a nice return, right? Immediately. And so, yeah, you probably do want to put money inside of your employer plan first, and then do the transfer later to a low-cost company with better investing options like Lively and Fidelity. So I hope that helps, Mike, make that transfer, get your money invested in some of those low-cost options with one of those great companies. Make it happen. All right, Matt, next question is from a listener who's wondering about CDs. Are those a better option than a savings account right now?
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Anna calling from Washington, D.C. Thanks for putting out a great show. I'm a new listener and really enjoy listening to the episodes when you answer listener questions. It's great to hear the questions other people have. I keep a majority of my savings in a high-yield savings account that at one time offered a 1.7% APY on my savings. However, due to the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates in response to the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, my bank recently reduced the rate they offer to customers to 1.55% and now even less at 1.3% APY. This is obviously frustrating for me as a customer, but I understand a lot of this is outside of anyone's control in these trying times. However, this financial institution is offering for customers to use a CD, which earns a 1.55 APY. This seems attractive given the additional boost in earnings, but I'm not really sure what the pros and cons are for CDs. And to be honest, I'm not exactly sure what a CD is. If it's helpful for context, I keep my 6 months emergency savings in this high yield savings account, and I'm trying to save for a down payment on a house. I of course want my emergency fund to be readily available given these uncertain times, but I probably won't need to touch my down payment savings for at least another 1, 2, 3, maybe even more years. Does moving my money to a CD make sense, or should I keep it in the high yield savings account and wait for the feds to raise interest rates after the pandemic in the hope that my savings account rate will eventually increase again? Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, Anna, great question, and we feel your pain. It's tough times right now for savers, for sure, but at least you're doing business with a bank that pays a decent interest rate. 1.3% is actually pretty good right now, but Anna, you know, we can expect interest rates to continue to fall on savings accounts for a little while. No one can reliably predict the future of interest rates, but it seems like savers might continue to get hammered for the foreseeable future, at least.
Yeah, so enter the CD, the certificate of deposit, and, you know, Matt, we haven't talked about CDs much on the show, and that's because we're not typically huge fans.
Right.
They don't make sense for the most part for people because online savings accounts have gotten pretty competitive and the rates being offered there have gotten really good. But because of what's happening right now, as rates are going down, CDs actually do tend to make a little bit more sense right now. So I'm glad Anna brought this question up. And let's talk about CDs just for a second. It stands for Certificate of Deposit. You put in a chunk of money with a bank for a set amount of time, and they'll pay you a given interest rate, right? A guaranteed rate of interest for a specific period of time. And one of the biggest downsides of a CD is that your money is tied up, right? That's why we're typically bigger fans of savings accounts, because they're more liquid. You can have access to your cash whenever you want.
They offer that flexibility.
Yeah, but CDs, not typically the case. Traditionally, you would actually pay a penalty if you pulled money out of your CD early, making it even less desirable.
That's right. But Joel, you know, like you just mentioned, given what has been going on with our economy right now, like a CD might actually make sense for folks. Because we are in a falling interest rate environment, you can lock in a decent rate with a CD, whereas that same rate in a high interest savings account could get sliced in half in the coming months, just like we've seen. And so again, you need to be cool with not touching that money for that given amount of time. But this is why today, this actually might make more sense for folks.
Yeah, and there's kind of a third option, Matt. CDs have kind of morphed with the times. Different banks have offered different kinds of CD products that make a little more sense for the modern era. And we're both big fans of the no penalty CDs that are out there. These no penalty CDs will give you the ability to lock in a higher rate without having to pay back interest if you pull the money out before the term is up. Ally, I think, actually kind of invented these, or if not, they at least popularized them. And they specifically have an 11-month no penalty CD with no minimum deposit required. So you're guaranteed a certain rate with kind of that added flexibility of a high interest savings account. I love that product. It's kind of the best of both worlds. And that could be kind of the perfect choice, the perfect place for Anna to put some of this money that she's hoping to have longer than a year, but she's not 100% sure that it's going to be in there longer than that.
Yeah, dude, no penalty. It's so good. Like it's win-win, basically. You know, there's no downside. In fact, I was so convinced of this that I actually opened one of these while we were researching this episode.
Oh, there you go.
Because there's no penalty for taking that money out, there is no downside. Hopefully, I won't have any need for that money that I've set aside and put in that CD. But if I do, I'm not going to get hit with the penalty, and I'll be able to keep all of that interest. And again, it's not necessarily because the rate that is being offered by the no penalty CD is that much higher. It's barely higher than like the savings account, but it's the potential for it just to stay locked in while the high interest savings decline in the coming months.
Yeah,
that's the real advantage there. And definitely if you already have an Ally account, which like I did, I mean, it literally took me 2 minutes to sign up for that and just move that money over, and boom, now I've got a savings, a checking, and CDs within that one little login.
There you go.
Real nice.
Nice. Yeah, man. One other thing that we can mention too about CDs is the ability to ladder CDs. And that basically means opening up you know, CDs of a few different lengths, like a 1, a 2, and a 3-year CD. And Anna could put equal amounts into each one in order to score slightly higher rates. Because, for instance, when that CD comes due in a year, if she wants to put money back into a 1-year CD, rates could be a good bit lower. So having that money in a 2- and a 3-year CD as well, allocating your money in that way in a slightly longer term savings vehicle like a CD via laddering could be a great option for Anna to earn a little more than kind of the paltry rates that we're starting to see more and more in just a simple high interest savings account.
Yeah, especially if you're able to couple that with that no penalty 1-year CD, well, then you have that easy access in case you need that money within an emergency fund while still growing your money at a higher rate with those other CDs. That sounds like a great plan. All right, Joel, we've got a couple more questions, including one as to whether someone should choose a 403B over a Roth. And then we've got one about shopping for the best mortgage rates. We'll get to those two right after the break. All right, Joel, we are back from the break, and our next question has to do with maintaining a good credit score while also shopping for a mortgage.
Hey guys, Brian from Alaska here, hoping you guys might be able to help me with a question I have about mortgages, specifically about getting the best mortgage rate possible. Anyway, my wife and I are getting ready to buy our first home. I'm getting ready to change positions with my current employer, and in doing so, that involves a move, and hopefully we're going to be able to purchase our very first home. Just a quick background, we have almost no debt between the two of us. All of our student loans and whatnot are paid off, and we have a fair amount of savings for a down payment. So we're gonna look probably at a traditional loan versus an FHA and not a VA loan or anything like that. But the question I had is, what is the best way to go about rate shopping for the best mortgage rate? I know that if I make any kind of hard hits on my credit line through trying to get pre-approvals, it can negatively affect my credit if I have too many of those. But at the same time, I'd like to shop around to a bunch of different companies so that I can get the best rate and the best terms on that loan, being I'm going to be paying it off for probably the next 30 years. I guess that leads me to question number two, which is there any advantage to going to a brick and mortar store versus going to one of these online mortgage brokers like Quicken Loans or Rocket Mortgage or anything like that? Is it just based loan to loan and person to person on the best terms that you can get? Or is there an advantage going to my credit union where I've been doing business for years and years? Thanks again, guys.
Brian, thanks for your question. Congrats on buying your first home. Also, too, it sounds like you and your wife have your finances in killer shape. So well done on that, too. And you definitely want to do your due diligence on this, right? Shopping around for a mortgage could mean saving big dollars. It could mean thousands of dollars in potential savings on closing costs and tens of thousands of dollars in interest saved over the life of the loan. Most people don't shop enough for a mortgage rate, considering how much money overall it can actually save you. It's one of those things that deserves just a little more time, a little more attention than most people give it.
Yeah, house shopping, lots of fun. Mortgage shopping, not so fun.
Exactly. Nobody wants to do it because it's not
fun.
Nobody
wants to do it, but you got to do it. So Brian, let's talk about how to actually go about shopping for the best rate. Since it sounds like you do have a relationship with a local credit union, you know, we would definitely recommend to get a quote with them. While we're not big fans of credit unions for the interest rate that they offer on savings accounts, they often offer some of the best rates out there on mortgages. So we would recommend that. A couple of my mortgages are with two different local credit unions here in Atlanta.
Yeah, I've got mortgages with a local credit union as well, Matt. I think they're a great place to turn when you're shopping for a mortgage. But it's also important to make sure you don't stop there. Make sure you get at least 3 quotes, preferably 5. Talk to a local mortgage broker as well, who shops with a variety of lenders. Brokers are typically paid by the lender for bringing them business. And the additional benefit of working with a broker is that they can shop around quickly with a bunch of different lenders for rates, which gets us to the next part of your question.
Yeah, Brian, it's tough to know exactly how shopping around will affect your credit score. But if a lender is using the latest FICO scoring model, then you have a 45-day window to comparison shop. In this case, hard pulls are going to be treated as just a single hard pull. But the worst case scenario is if they're using an older credit scoring model where you might only have a 14-day window where those multiple credit checks are treated as a single pull. But even still, even with the old models where you only have 14 days, I feel like it's pretty easy to go mortgage shopping within a 2-week period. You know, you just need to stay organized, knock it all out at once, and that would have the least impact on your credit score. But at the same time, people say like they don't want to ding their credit score. And here's the thing, that kind of language, like when you say, I don't want to ding it, what does that make you think of? makes you think of a nice fancy car. But like, again, I want to push people towards seeing their credit score as a tool, like something that needs to get dinged up a little bit every now and then, right? Go ahead and put it to use. That's what it's there for, especially for a mortgage. This is probably the largest loan, the largest transaction where your credit score is going to be able to help you out.
Yeah, your credit score matters the absolute most when you're mortgage shopping. Other things, it's nice to have a good credit score, but mortgage shopping, it could save you a ridiculous amount of money.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. But Brian asked about going with a brick and mortar versus an online lender. And yeah, Brian, there is an advantage to using a local lender, right? There's typically a personal relationship that goes along with that. And that person, that local credit union or bank, often has added incentive and ability to make sure that you get to the closing table on time. So while online lenders are great for a refinance, and some of them will do a good job at speeding you through underwriting, I personally prefer working with a local lender on a home purchase because I don't want to get sucked in by, you know, just an awesome rate and then realize that they're not actually going to be able to get me to the finish line, to the closing table on time and have a contract fall through because of it. I have friends who are real estate investors who have had that happen. They've tried to go with the absolute best rate and it was through an online lender, and then they didn't get taken care of in the end.
Yeah, there's a balance of customer service as well as the best rate possible.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So again, online lenders, great for refis, not necessarily ideal for a home purchase.
Yeah, this is especially true for you, Brian, since it sounds like this is your first home that you guys are purchasing. When you haven't done this before, there's a lot of moving parts and not everything goes as smoothly as you might hope it would when you're purchasing a home. And so especially considering that this is your first home, we would maybe recommend going with a local credit union a little more than with an online lender. And Brian, one other thought that's maybe not as financially related, but it sounded like, too, that you're getting this promotion or you're getting a new position with your job and you're moving at the same time. We might, you know, recommend not doing these things, I guess, at the exact same time, especially if you're moving to a newer area. In instances like that, there's a lot of benefit to renting, you know, for a little bit ahead of time, getting to know an area, really figuring out where it is that you want to purchase. Because like purchasing a home is a huge deal. It's a big decision. And unless you've really researched the area, you're really familiar with not only the neighborhoods, but the streets, because, you know, neighborhoods can vary from street to street. I know it's a pain and it does not sound fun to say, hey, babe, let's rent for 3 months or 6 months or even a year while we get to know the new city. But I think that could really end up being something that helps you guys out finding a place that you really love for the long term.
Yeah, man, I think that's great advice. Doing all those things at the same time, that's a lot going on. And in particular, moving to a new area without renting first, not typically ideal. We're big fans of people renting.
No, we don't hate on renting at all.
No, we certainly don't. And we're all about people renting before they buy in a new city so they get to know their surroundings first before they decide where they want to land for good. All right, Matt, let's get to our next question, though. This one's from an OG listener.
Hi, Joel and Matt. This is David from Seattle. I've been a listener since day one, but this is my first time calling in. I'd love to get your thoughts on my 403b. My employer only contributes their match once per year, and it isn't guaranteed. And I'm not confident that they're going to make their 2% match this year. And while the options are decent, which are Vanguard target funds, I'm not sure I see any advantage to continuing making these contributions to my employer pre-tax fund if they don't make their match. And even if they do, I'm still missing out on that full year of growth on their match. It's worth pointing out that the target fund's expense ratio is 0.15%, and 11% of the fund is in bonds. My partner and I are still very early in the wealth building stage, and I'd rather be more aggressive and go 100% stocks. So my question is, wouldn't post-tax contributions to a low-cost IRA be better, since taxes are probably going to be higher in the future when I draw on my pre-tax funds? Or am I missing something? Or maybe it's better to keep contributing that 2% to see if my employer does make their match, and then open an IRA for anything above and beyond that. Let me know what you guys think. And if you're ever out in Seattle, let me know, and I'll show you some good spots. Thanks a lot, guys. Keep it up.
David, thanks for the question and thanks for that offer as well. I love Seattle. I've only been out there one time, but I think we hit it perfectly. Like, it didn't rain at all. The skies are blue. It was beautiful. It's the middle of the summer.
You didn't actually experience Seattle then?
Well, I experienced Portland. Portland, when we went to Portland, was super rainy, but okay. Seattle was beautiful.
Man, Seattle in like September, It's like the best time to go. It's such a beautiful city.
Isn't it freezing though in September?
No, it's not too cold yet. And I think it's one of the drier months of the year. And it's, you know, it's still, it's so green. It's beautiful.
Yeah, we were there in June and I was surprised at how cool it was. but it was really beautiful. And Joel, it's worth mentioning too, this is the David who sent us a beer back in the day. He sent us a coffee porter made by the coffee beans that his company roasts. The company is a nonprofit that gets, and this is from their website, street-involved young people to discover and employ their gifts by serving coffee in our community. The name of his company is Street Bean Coffee Roasters, and that's why he has a 403B, because they're actually a nonprofit, which is super cool, and I'm glad that we're kind of coming full circle and get to answer a little question here for David.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, David said he'd been listening since day one. That's a long time ago, David. So, yeah, we appreciate you listening, man. We appreciate that beer back in the day. And yeah, let's get to the heart of David's question. He's asking about whether he should be putting his money in that 403B or in a Roth. And first of all, it's excellent that you have access to Vanguard funds in your 403B, right? But Roth IRAs, which are post-tax, are a better option in our opinion, especially for folks with a lower adjusted gross income, right? Paying the tax now and never paying it again if you're in one of those super low tax brackets, like let's say you're in the 12% tax bracket, it's such an excellent idea to be able to pay the tax now and never pay tax on that money again. It's similar to the interest rate combo that we had earlier, right? Taxes are just as hard to predict as interest rates. Like, are they going to go up? Are they going to go down? Should I put my money in a CD or should I keep it in a savings account?
Don't know, man.
We think that interest rates are going to keep falling, but that's really hard to predict.
And we think that tax rates are going to go up because they're really cheap right now.
Right. But that's, again, hard to predict. And So, sometimes you just kind of have to make an educated decision and go with the bird in the hand. And that's why I think everything else being equal, we would say a Roth IRA is a better decision than the 403B.
Yeah. And David, there's a chance that you can kind of get the best of both worlds. You know, the last suggestion that you had seems to be your best bet. Contribute that 2%, hoping for a match, and then put the rest in a total stock market or S&P 500 fund with one of the different low-cost providers out there. And even if they don't match, that target date fund that you have there with an expense ratio of 0.15%, that's totally acceptable. And even 11% in bonds is pretty standard for young investors. But we are with you, though, and we like the 100% stock allocation if you can handle the increased volatility. I, for one, I'm all about that volatility, Joel. I actually have zero of my retirement in bonds, because I want to see that volatility. I want to see that up and down, because I know that like volatility and increased gains in the market, like they're basically attached at the hip. You can't have one without the other. And so if you're a little bit younger, or if you're at least younger in your investing career, going with more stocks is definitely what we would recommend.
Yeah, the increased volatility is going to lead to increased reward over the long term. So yeah, but David, yeah, sounds like that's probably the best option for you, that hybrid approach that Matt mentioned. And best of luck to you and your investing endeavors. All right, Matt, let's take it back to the beer. Today on the show, we drank a beer called Pseudo Sue. It's a pale ale by Toppling Goliath Brewing Company out of Iowa. Well, what was your take on this beer, man?
Man, this was such a good beer. I really, really enjoyed this one. And I kind of kept myself from explaining this beer at the beginning of the episode, but it's called Pseudo Sue because there's a beer called King Sue, which we've had on the show, which is an IPA. And so this is the pale ale version of that beer. So it's, I guess, slightly, some would say, dumbed down a little bit. You know, it's like kind of the fake IPA version. But honestly, man, I might even like this one, the Pseudo Sue, better than I like the King Sue. Like, we don't have this side by side, and so it's hard to make a comparison like that without kind of doing an A-B test here. But I really like this one. I really like the lighter mouthfeel that accompanies a pale ale. But this one in particular, it has a lot of hop presence, and the hops taste really fresh. This is one of those pale ales that tastes really alive to me. And man, if I can get an IPA or a pale ale that tingles in my mouth a little bit because it just tastes so fresh, it's going to win me over every single time. But I really enjoyed this one, man. It was kind of one of those hazy pale ales. But yeah, what were your thoughts on this beer, buddy?
Yeah, man, this was a delicious beer. It's a single hop beer. So yeah, most IPAs or pale ales, they use like 4 and 5 different hop varieties simultaneously at the same time. And that assortment, the hops as they blend together, kind of create this interesting symphony, right? But
yeah, like a little fruit punch.
Right, yeah. But one hop, trying to do one hop by itself, it's going to make that singular hop flavor stand out in a big way. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And on this beer, it worked out really, really well. It was Citra only on this bad boy. And I would say it was an incredibly smooth pale ale with so much hop flavor. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, Pseudo Sue. It's just as good as King Sue, if not better. I got to agree with you, man.
Yeah, and so thanks again to Kelsey out in Iowa for sending this one our way. We've been lucky to have a bunch of Toppling Goliath on the show lately. So looking forward to our next episode as well, because we get to have another beer.
Right, exactly. All right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. For folks that want show notes for this episode, just go to our website, howtomoney.com. You can find those there.
And if you're not already, we would love for you to be a subscriber. Just mash that button on your podcatcher and you can be like David, a longtime listener. And if you haven't already as well, we would love for you to head over to Apple Podcasts where you can leave us hopefully a nice review, and that'll help us to spread the word and help others to find this podcast who need to be doing better and smarter things with their money.
That's our goal, man. All right, Matt, until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.